Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
I'm Patty James, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine member-led forum and chair of this program. It's my pleasure to extend a special welcome to any new club members who are here today. We know you will enjoy your membership and look forward to seeing you often. At this time, please turn off your cell phones and other noise-making devices because we are recording the program today that you will see on the website in a few days so you can listen to it again. Now, here are some upcoming health and medicine forum events coming up. Next week on Tuesday, go vote and then come to this program on the miracles of microsurgery. Dr. Gregory Bunke, internationally known. It's from fingers to facial reconstruction to sexual reassignment. He does some very interesting work at his clinic here in the Bay Area. And then on November 13 is JAWS. And that's not JAWS that sharks, that's the kind that we have right here that are not doing as well in our young people as they used to. And that's that speaker is Sandra Kahn and Paul Ehrlich. And you might, well, not a lot of you, but some of you might remember the population bomb that came out a long time ago. So that's November 13th. So those are just a few, two of many upcoming programs, and invite you to pick up a copy of the new Commonwealth Club publication publication in the lobby, or check our website for a complete listing of our events. You may register for these programs online at commonwealthclub.org or by calling the club's 24-hour reservation line. And again, we will be collecting the questions that we'll ask the last 15 minutes. And I already reminded you twice, but I have to say it one more time to make sure that you don't have anything that's going to ring or beep during the program. So here we are. So this is, if I had a gavel, I would be tapping it right now. Knock, knock, knock. Greetings, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Patty James, Vice Chair of the Club, co-chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. It's my pleasure to announce our four speakers today. I'm going to stand over here so you don't have to look at me. You can look at them. And Alyssa Appel. PhD is a professor at the Department of Psychiatry at UCSF. Alyssa studied psychology and psychobiology at Stanford University and clinical and health psychology at Yale University. She completed a clinical internship at the Palo Alto Veterans Healthcare System. Her research aims to educate mechanisms of healthy aging and to apply this basic science to scalable interventions that can reach vulnerable populations. She is director of Aging, Metabolism, and Emotions Lab and the Center for Obesity, Study, and Treatment, which is the acronym is COAST, and associate director of the Center for Health and Community. With her collaborators, she is conducting clinical trials to examine the effect of self-regulation and mindfulness training programs on cellular aging, weight, diet, and glucose control. Wolfram Alderson's career, there he is, in pursuit of social environmental change spans across four decades. He currently serves as the CEO of the Hypoglycemia Support Foundation. The broad focus of his lifetime of work has been improving human and environmental health, often by developing programs and organizations that accomplish both. In addition to being a social change agent, Wolfram is also a visual artist and writer, an amazing one at that, and has built two major therapeutic art programs, one for refugees and one for abused children. Dr. Robert Lustig specializes in the field of neuroendocrinology with an emphasis on the regulation of energy balance by the central nervous system. His research and clinical practice has focused on childhood obesity and diabetes. Dr. Lustig holds a bachelor's in science from MIT, a doctorate in medicine from Cornell University, and a master's of studies in law. In his spare time, he went back and got his law degree from UC Hastings College of Law. Dr. Lustig is the author of two of best-selling books, one which we have out there. I think we have more than one of your books, actually. His latest book is The Hacking of the American Mind, The Science Behind the Corporate Takeover of Our Bodies and Brains, and Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. And actually, to backtrack a bit, Alyssa's book on telomeres is out there as well. I'm sorry, that got missed in your bio. And then Natalie Razgon. How did I do there, Natalie? Good. Is the professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences and Obstetrics and Gynecology at Stanford University School of Medicine. She began her distinguished career at Odessa Medical Institute and the UCLA School of Medicine. And in 2000, she established the Center for Neuroscience in Women's Health at Stanford University. Dr. Razgon is considered a renowned expert in neuroendocrinology and women's mental health. She is the author of more than 165 peer-reviewed publications, 25 book chapters, and is a reviewer for 30 professional journals. Her predominant research focus has been on the neuroendocrine correlates in various models of affective and cognitive neuroscience, the treatment of bipolar disorder in women, and the use of hormonal interventions during menopause and the effects of mood and cognitive function, and the interplay between endocrine function and aging. I know, right? What can you say? So thank you all for being here. This is amazing. We won't clap quite yet, though I do feel like we all should right now. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm supposed to be sitting here so they don't look at me over there and they look at you. So I'm sorry for my back towards you. The common definition of metabolic syndrome is that it's a risk of cluster of risk factors, increased blood pressure, high blood sugar, excess body fat, and particularly around the waist and high triglyceride levels. This can lead to an increase in the risk of heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and stroke. So that's the current understanding of what metabolic syndrome is. So Dr. Lustig, do you agree with that?
First of all, Patty, thank you for assembling this. Thank Bill Grant as well for all of his work in making the Commonwealth Club, shall we say, you know, health care and healthiness central in San Francisco and the Bay Area. So I want
to
thank you for all the work you do. Metabolic syndrome. Everyone heard of it? Yeah? What do you think it is?
Oh, don't ask them. We're not doing questions yet.
Piece of junk. Piece of junk. Okay. When you don't know what something is, you call it a syndrome. That's the way it works. It's the way it works throughout all of medicine. And in fact, six separate medical organizations have tried to define metabolic syndrome, and they all defined it differently. So what's that telling you? It's telling you that five of them are wrong. At least five, and probably all six. And the reason is because all of these definitions seek to take these phenomenological issues that, you know, high blood pressure, glucose intolerance, low HDL, high triglyceride, obesity, etc., and figure out where they're abnormal in terms of the standard deviation around the mean. Well, these are not bimodal distributions, none of these. These are all skewed kurtotic distributions. So, for instance, if you have a blood pressure, systolic blood pressure in the 90th percentile, you have metabolic syndrome. But if it's in the 89th percentile, you don't. I mean, like, how dumb is that? Okay? This is the kind of thing, you know, the triglycerides, the same things. 95th, oh, that's metabolic syndrome, but 94th is not. I mean, none of this makes any sense whatsoever. Okay? It is true that these diseases cluster, and every single one of the diseases within metabolic syndrome has gone through the roof. And in fact, there are now new diseases that we never even saw before that are part of this cluster as well, such as non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. This was a disease that had never been seen before 1980, and now 40% of America has it. You want to talk about epidemics? That's the epidemic. Okay? Even in, at its worst, HIV was not even close to that. Or influenza, not even close to that. Not Ebola or anything else, for that matter, that has captured the world's medical imagination. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is now one quarter of the world. The paper just came out. One quarter of the world. Okay, you have it. And you don't even know it. So the question is, what is it? Where did it come from? Why are all these diseases going up? How come diabetes is going up faster than obesity? Everyone says, well, it's obesity. It's not obesity. Because thin people get all of these diseases too. Now, they get it at a slightly lower rate. That's true. They get it at a rate of 40% versus 80%. So it is true that obesity is a risk factor, but obesity is not the cause. It travels with these diseases, but it's not the cause. Because you can be something called MHO, metabolically healthy obese.
Okay.
You can live a completely normal life, die at a completely normal age, not cost the taxpayer a dime, have normal telomeres. Right, Alyssa?
Well, we don't know about that.
Okay. You're just fat. Okay. Conversely, 40% of the normal weight population has metabolic syndrome, and a lot of them don't even know it. So this notion of these diseases is just junk. Okay, each of these diseases is a manifestation of a metabolic problem within the organ you're looking at. And the question is, what is that metabolic problem? If it's in the kidney, it looks like chronic renal failure. If it's in the liver, it looks like fatty liver disease. If it's in the ovary, it looks like polycystic ovarian disease. If it's in the heart, it looks like coronary artery disease. If it's in the brain, it looks like dementia and other behavioral problems, which we will talk about today. So the question is, what is it? And the answer is, we now know. It's mitochondrial dysfunction in whatever organ you're looking at. So the mitochondria are the little energy-burning factories inside each cell. And those mitochondria have a peak efficiency, but they're easily perturbed. And if you perturb them, you get disease. And the question is, what's perturbing them? And the answer is everything. Everything that is in our current environment. Technology is part of it. Sugar, processed food, lack of sleep, drugs, all impact mitochondrial function in one fashion or another. Stress impact mitochondrial function one way or another. And ultimately, all of these lead to behavioral / metabolic changes that tend to go together. This is metabolic syndrome. There are three ways to get there, and I'll finish with that. You can become so obese that your fat cells start spilling toxic remnants and cytokines and make your liver sick. And once your liver gets sick, that's it. You've got metabolic syndrome. Or you can develop visceral fat from stress, like depression. Depressed people lose weight, but they have metabolic syndrome because the visceral fat goes up, which makes the liver sick, and then you get that too. Or you can mainline it straight to the liver. Not pass and go, not collecting $200. You can make your liver sick straight away, straight from your diet. That's called soft drinks. So there are three different reasons why your liver gets sick. But once your liver gets sick, you have mitochondrial dysfunction everywhere. That is metabolic syndrome.
Oh, did anybody know that? Everybody know that? We all do now, huh? Dr. Razgon, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I actually completely agree with Dr. Lustig about the notion that metabolic syndrome is a cluster of many independent illnesses, and the notion of it is silly. What I would say is that when all these conditions occur, and I think that's what you were trying to address, Rob, is that it's a little too late. We need to look at how to protect ourselves from developing those conditions. And there are a number of pathological processes which we can identify and understand before we go into developing fatty liver or developing coronary artery disease or hypertension. So that's all I would say for now. And we will talk about that as time goes on.
All right. Dr. Appel? Nothing to add?
No.
Okay. Wolfram?
I think that covered it, and I'll talk more
about specifics.
Hypoglycemia.
Okay. So next, we were discussing back and forth on to the point of diagnosis. Besides, you know, the diet and everything, and Rob, we were mentioning genotypes and phenotypes, and I'd like everybody to weigh in on that. So just briefly, then, could you start by explaining the difference between a phenotype and a genotype?
So a genotype is what your genes are. A phenotype is what your biochemistry is and what expresses itself outwardly. Ultimately, a phenotype is a interaction between your genotype and the environment. That gives you a phenotype. Here's the problem. When you do the genetic analyses on people with metabolic syndrome, and these are called GWAS studies, genome-wide association studies, hundreds of thousands of patients with their genetic information all, sorted. Turns out only about 15% of the genetic material is associated with metabolic syndrome. Not very much. In fact, quite little. Which means that the rest of it is what the geneticists call dark matter, okay? Which, unfortunately, the environmentalists call the environment.
And Alyssa is going to talk about the exposome.
That's right. Yeah. The things that have come to basically haunt us and, sort of gone through the roof over the last 50 years. And Alyssa is going to, explain that. There are certain genotypes that put you at risk. I'll give you an example of one. In Latinos, they have a genetic polymorphism in a gene that codes for a liver protein. The name of the gene is called PNPLA3, Patatin-like protein phospholipase domain A3. If you have the GG genotype, which is the abnormal one, okay, which is only 19% of Latinos, but if you have that, a little sugar makes a lot of liver fat and drives non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and metabolic dysfunction very quickly. So these people are particularly prone to getting disease. So there's an example, but that's relatively, shall we say, uncommon. I mean, we're talking about 19% of the Latino population. Okay? There are a lot of other people who have metabolic syndrome who don't have that problem. So there are other things that can, sort of put you at risk. But ultimately, it's an interaction between the genes and the environment, because if those Latinos didn't drink a soda, they wouldn't have it. Mm. Everybody got it?
Yeah. Wolfram, if you would, explain hypoglycemia and what it has to do with metabolic health.
Great. Well, thank you. And, the introduction about metabolic syndrome is very similar when you describe hypoglycemia. It's sort of like the blind man in the room with the elephant. The doctors and clinicians and so on all see hypoglycemia from their own lens or perspective. Hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, is associated with almost every major medical condition. A pretty significant portion of people going into hospital emergency rooms have hypoglycemia. So it's ubiquitous across many health conditions, and so you'll get many different definitions. The fellow that really first described hypoglycemia, Dr. Seal Harris in the 1940s, said low blood sugar today is the diabetes of tomorrow. The point of the remark wasn't that it's inevitable if you have low blood sugar, you get diabetes. The point was that this is something to pay attention to, a physical condition that's important to pay attention to. And if you do early on, you can prevent more serious metabolic disorders from occurring. The other interesting thing is that isn't really talked too much about is that you can't just look at low blood sugar. It's a roller coaster. It's high blood sugar, then low blood sugar, then high blood sugar, then low blood sugar. And for many, like me in my past, and I'm sure many of you know what it's like to be on that roller coaster during the day. You start out with a big load of carbohydrates in the morning, then you're hitting caffeine, you get a drop, another, maybe some more carbs, more caffeine, etc. Many people are on that roller coaster throughout the day. So it's not just low blood sugar, it's really the blood sugar roller coaster, blood sugar dysregulation. So it's a sign, if you will, and there'll be doctors that argue, well, it's not a disease, it's a condition or a symptom. The important thing is that it is a sign, and that if we pay attention to it early on, that we can make a difference in our health. The type of hypoglycemia that I'm most concerned about and the Hypoglycemia Support Foundation are concerned about is the type that is most common, commonly referred to as reactive or functional hypoglycemia. And so we're less concerned with some of the clinical definitions and more concerned with the practical concerns. And we've, for example, surveyed thousands of people over the years. The Hypoglycemia Support Foundation is 40 years old. And the most common symptom that people come to us with is depression. About 50% of the people who have hypoglycemia are experiencing depression. So you would not see that necessarily in the clinical textbooks that depression is related necessarily to hypoglycemia, although you'll see it associated with hypoglycemia with many different conditions. So it can be confusing if you're going online and looking for information. And of course, one of the common things that a doctor might even tell you is, well, have some crackers and some orange juice, and that may be what you have to do in an acute hypoglycemic state. But what if you're experiencing hypoglycemia chronically? That's where our focus is. You have to do what you have to do. If your blood sugar has dropped to a dangerous level, and of course, type 1 diabetics have unaware hypoglycemia, and that can kill you. But I'm talking about the vast majority of the population that experience some form of blood sugar dysregulation. It's related to diet, and it's preventable. And it's a nutrition problem that can be solved. So hopefully that explained in a nutshell.
Yes, thank you. So, Dr. Razgon, so again, one of those general definitions like that was completely debunked by Rob with regards to metabolic syndrome, but severe mental illness, and this is just something I read as a definition, is defined by the length and duration of disability. So number one, is that correct? And what are the major and minor, and I put the word minor in quotes here, of mental illness? Of illnesses, and how are they tied to metabolic syndrome? Big question, I know.
It's as big as your introduction of me. I mean, we could spend probably 5 days just talking about the answer. But the definition of mental illness is whatever symptoms it represents, it has to be associated with change in functional capacity. So if my dog runs away, I can be depressed about it, but if I go to work and I do all my duties and responsibilities, that doesn't constitute depression. If I cannot function at a certain level, then that constitutes the illness, whichever illness it is. Let me bring it back to what we're talking about here with regard to glucose control and all that. So it's fascinating to think of how depression is associated with mental illness. And I know Dr. Appel will talk about stress, how that evokes us or predisposes people to diabetes. So diabetes is the end stage. I just want you to understand that. The hypoglycemia, the hyperglycemia, whenever glucose levels change from normal, that's the train which left that station will never come back. In depression, we see, unfortunately, so that's the bad news. I don't have many good news in that. In depression, we see, unfortunately, even in children with depressive disorders now, pre-diabetes, so the condition which precedes that train leaving the station. And that's what I was trying to say when I say that we need to look at earlier stages. One of the conditions to consider is the condition called insulin resistance, when there is normal glucose in the blood, but elevated insulin, fasting insulin, whichever way you try it. What happens in that condition, which may last for decades, is that there are ongoing defective processes going on all over the body and in the brain. And that's what we want to kind of take as a message to you and to say, in stress, in depression, we can identify early development of the prediabetes, which could, in fact, relate to depressed mood. So, what in depression could be predisposing to that? One of the things you mentioned was it's a sleepless, anorexic condition on what we call, in technical words, phenotype, right? So the clinical presentation of depression, the classical presentation. Person doesn't sleep, person doesn't eat enough, is very antsy. It's not necessarily the case. Like anything else in science, there are many, many, many iterations on that. And there are plenty of people, in fact, more than 40% of patients with depression, who sleep too much, eat too much. And there is that change in this energy distribution in what people take in and what people give out, which may predispose to that endocrine dysfunction.
Can I add to that for a moment?
Of course, I'm setting it up for you.
Thank you. Well, you teed it up good. All right, now I gotta hit it with my driver. Down the fairway. We've now brought up this phenomenon called depression. Anybody know what that is? In fact, there's not one depression. There's at least two, and there are probably more. One of them is called melancholic depression. It's the depression that, you know, they make movies about. Okay? You know, with, lobotomies and, you know, electroconvulsive therapy, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? Melancholic depression is very real, and it's been around for a very long time. But it's about the same frequency as it always was. It's a real disease, and it's a real problem, but it's not going up. Then there's this other depression, which is called agitated depression or atypical depression. And it's a different disease. Melancholic depression, you can't even get out of bed. Melancholic depression, you can't even eat. Melancholic depression, you want to kill yourself. Agitated or atypical depression, you don't want to kill yourself. You want to eat a lot. And you are agitated. You can't go to sleep. So these are two different phenomena. And the question is, that type of depression, the agitated depression, has about quadrupled in the last 10 years. So depression is not depression. I think they're two completely different phenomena, two completely different diseases. And when you look at the people who have agitated depression, they have, guess what? Metabolic syndrome. They have insulin resistance. They have mitochondrial dysfunction. And I think, I can't prove it, I wish I could, but I think it's because of what they're eating.
So what they're eating, and also maybe other lifestyle components, which you have been working on for many years, Dr. Appel, and that is stress. So let's, if you would, talk about stress and metabolic syndrome, and how it's tied back into mental health, and perhaps touch on telomeres a little bit, mm-hmm. since that's your book out there, and a little definition of that as well.
Sure, Patty. So we've been talking about symptoms, syndromes, and clinical syndromes of depression, and how complicated and heterogeneous they are. And I want to reel us way back to thinking about really our own lives every day, and what we do that pushes us along that spectrum towards syndrome and sickness. So let's just start with psychological stress. It is a precursor to all of this. It's no surprise to anyone. But there are many interesting different ways. So I want you to think about your own life and periods of stress and how that affects you, your behavior, what you eat, how you sleep, how you might gain weight or lose weight. So it's pretty potent. So I'm going to give you a few examples of the pathways. So one is that it shapes what we eat. So this is the most obvious one, that it actually makes us crave dense calories. So it's not carrots and salad, but rather sugar, sweetness, sweet with fat. And those are calming to the brain. So it's a kind of a positive feedback loop where we might get some immediate relief from the sugar with a long-term cost. So having stress and eating that type of comfort food actually creates this body habitus we've been talking about with the visceral fat. This was in the 1980s, this syndrome was discovered by a psychiatrist named Per Bjorntorp from Sweden, and he just started looking at different large data sets, and over he documented that mental illness, any mental illness, being on an any drug that was for a mental condition, was associated with this body shape and this metabolic syndrome. And that is, as Natalie said, that's too late. So let's go back to thinking about our daily life and what those pathways are that brought people there. So we talked about behavior, choosing comfort food. And in the short run, that's physiology. There's a homeostasis there. In the long run, it has a buildup toward insulin resistance and visceral fat. What happens when we eat a meal when our body is under stress? So our colleague Jan Kiekel-Glaser just recently did a study where she documented what stressful things happened in people's lives. She brought them all into the lab and had them eat a big fatty breakfast. And what she found was that she could predict how much inflammation occurred from that breakfast. Everyone's eating the exact same thing. But those who had stressful events the day before had a big inflammatory burst after eating that same meal. So it's changing how we respond to food. Whether the food is junk food or not, we're going to have a worse metabolic response.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
What about sleep? Sleep is, people have called it the royal highway to obesity. And when we don't get a sufficient amount of sleep, that also is offsetting and decalibrating our metabolism so that we're more insulin resistant, we have more cravings. And so we're just finely attuned creatures to these survival threats. And when we feel stressed, we are then changing our metabolism in ways that are invisible. And if we could see them, this would all be a lot easier, right? And so the real story there is, yes, short-term stress we recover from, metabolically, long-term stress, we get these buildup of syndromes. So we really want to think about how stress is affecting us individually, which of those pathways are active in us. If we could just see the brain, we can't see how what we're eating affects it, but if we could see that and we had a little meter, we would treat it much better. We wouldn't be having, you know, things like soda, like liquid sugar that's going to create this big insulin rush, because that is absolutely affecting the brain, cognition. People think it's very much tied to the pathway to Alzheimer's. And the Alzheimer's is definitely part of this whole syndrome that we're talking about.
Okay, thank you. Well, from your experience with the Hypoglycemia Foundation, do you have, you probably concur with everything Alyssa just mentioned. Anything to add or
yes,
build upon?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's encouraging now that this field of nutritional psychiatry is emerging. So there's really a formal connection being made between nutrition and health, and so that's an exciting field to watch and pay attention to. And of course, the people here on the stage are, you know, very much a part of that movement, connecting the dots between, you know, our mental health and our metabolic health. With over the 40 years of the Hypoglycemia Support Foundation, and I should say, The Hypoglycemia Support Foundation was founded by now just a lovely little lady from Florida who had no medical background but had had a couple of children and was experiencing chronic conditions and depression and a variety of other symptoms over a couple of years, and went from one doctor to the next until one day a doctor said, "We finally have the cure for her, for you," and sent her off to a hospital, and they gave her a series of electroshock treatments. And it was so traumatic and terrifying to her, eventually she was able to come out and talk about it and found the Hypoglycemia Support Foundation. So clearly these conditions, these perturbing early effects in metabolic disorder have been connected with unhealthy mental states for a long time and been getting the wrong treatments. We've, you've probably all heard of the sugar blues. Dr. Carl Pfeiffer referred to that, and things like brain fog and being hangry. How many of you have been hangry? Just raise your hands, you know. So you all seem to know what that is, but clearly our what's going on with our food affects our mood and our stress and so many different things. We've, patients and people that come to us frequently refer to nervousness, irritability, insomnia, mental confusion, forgetfulness, inability to concentrate, anxiety, phobias and fears, misperceptions, emotional outbursts, chronic headaches, and we've even, there's been books written on the subject of even criminal behaviors, and we've heard of things like the Twinkie defense, etc. So clearly, this is a really important connection. I've been encouraged to see, Dr. Eppel was mentioning, if there was just a little meter or something that could tell us what's going on with our brain, well, one thing that I'm looking at very closely is the continuous glucose monitoring technology, which has been used for years for type 1 diabetics, which I think are less than 1% of the population. But the next big thing is they'll be available to type 2 diabetics, which is more like 40%. And then the next big thing, they'll be available to everybody. In fact, companies like Fitbit are investing heavily. There's at least one company here in San Francisco that they're investing in. And what that means is, for example, I know a doctor in Portland, Oregon. She's a psychiatrist, and she's built her practice around connecting mental health with metabolic health. And she basically loans her patients a continuous glucose monitor because most of her patients are not covered by insurance to buy one. She loans them the device, and the first week they just eat like they are normally, so she gets a baseline. And then week two, she just does a really basic carbohydrate restriction. Get them off sodas, get them off most junk food, carbohydrates, etc. And the difference in the charts are just really amazing to see, where week one you see this the roller coaster effect that I was talking about, and then week two that just looks more like a bumpy road ride. So I think clearly the technology is going to evolve, and I think it's going to become more accurate and more readily available to more people. But I think that's one really encouraging sign that I see out there that really shows a very graphic connection between what we eat and our blood sugar and our mood. And if you start to track your moods and look at those, how they correlate to what you're eating, I think we're going to start to get a more clear picture of what's really going on.
Yeah. Thank you. Alyssa, one more thing. If you could, the exposome, could you explain what the exposome is? And you talked about sleep and stress, but
yes.
If you could talk about the
Good
other
question,
aspects.
Heidi. I think this is becoming a much more common concept. So we have the genome. We thought all the answers about our human health were going to be, from decoding our genes. And then we have the exposome, which is everything outside of our body, the environment. And as Rob said, the environment plays a really large role in our health, both in interacting with our genes, but direct effects. The older we are, the more our health is shaped by our lifestyle, our daily life, and less by our genetics. So what is in that exposome bubble around all of us? There's air pollution, smart particles that are absorbed in our lungs and our blood that create inflammatory disorders, not just asthma, and has been linked to chronic diseases. So that's one example of chemicals and pollution. What else? We all have chemicals in our blood that we don't know about. So, for example, Roundup. Has anyone heard about Roundup lately? it's pretty disturbing, but there is a buildup of this chemical in our blood, glyphosate, over the decades. A large survey was done longitudinally and followed people and found that it's dramatically increasing over time because so much of our food, our source that keeps us alive every day, is filled with Roundup and other chemicals. So let me give you another example. The plasticizers, so things like BPA in the bottles, this is linked directly to diabetes. There's a strong association. So we've gotten BPA out of the bottles. Great, right? We're using a bunch of other chemicals that haven't been tested that may be just as bad or worse than BPA. So we really have a problem with all these exposures and the tons of chemicals are being made every day. And why are all these chemicals affecting our metabolism so much? They are endocrine disruptors, many of them. They're either blocking the receptor, exaggerating the receptors for hormones, and they're creating metabolic havoc in our bodies. So this is a low-grade chronic problem that affects all of us, some more than others. This is not, so no one escapes this. People who live near highways, of course, are affected more deeply. But the burden of the exposome, particularly the chemical exposome and the stress exposome, is in people of low income, people who live in poor neighborhoods. And the amount of chemicals they're exposed to is dramatically increased. If you look at a heat map, you can see there's a lot of chemicals, not just from the different food sources, but from the ground, from the air, that is really just saturating people who live in socially disadvantaged areas.
Thank you.
Let me add something to that because I'm really glad that you brought up the exposome kind of a story. There is another part of it, which we don't think about, but that's something which Rob referred to as environment, and that is epigenetics. So there's a genetics, there are genes, and there's epigenetics.
Good.
Let me tell you in one sentence what I mean by that. It's actually effect of upbringing. It's a family history. It's a way people eat in the family and they teach their children how to eat. It's also trauma. There is mm-hmm. such a profound effect of the early childhood exposure to abuse, neglect. And we're not talking about the sexual abuse or rape or extreme violence. It could be just elevated tone of voice or lack of attention to the child. And we see now how profoundly that affects their not only emotional regulation in the brain, but also their ability, their vulnerability to stressors later in life, and therefore development of these toxic cascades we're discussing today. So just think about, take one step back and think not necessarily just about one part of it, but in a bigger picture. Mm-hmm. Exposome, poor childhood exposure to good food intake, trauma, then hyperglycemia, depression, diabetes. Mm-hmm. That's all. There is a certain road.
Yeah. I want to just comment.
By the way, we haven't touched on one particular mental health issue yet. So let me just throw it in to completely mess everything up. Addiction. Talked about depression. We haven't talked about addiction. Addiction's going up just as fast as depression. So turns out they're related. They're related. And the things that ultimately cause depression also cause addiction. Different neurotransmitter, different area of the brain, different set of receptors. But ultimately, they go hand in hand. So add that to the toxic mix.
We have so many amazing questions here, and they are tied in. I just threw down my questions, and I'm going to jump right in to audience questions because there's some really great ones here. And I'm going to try to get as many of these in the next 20 minutes as possible. So I know that puts you on, in the level of having to be really succinct, but if at all possible, and I'll ask the question and then just jump in. I'm not going to direct it to any one person. So is there a fad or trend in society today that is the most destructive? Rob, go ahead. I know you're going to say it.
I've written about it, so I'll just throw it out. Processed food.
Yeah.
Processed food. Processed food is high sugar, low fiber. Real food is low sugar, high fiber. The sugar causes that mainlining, the insulin resistance. It also ups the dopamine. The dopamine changes dopamine receptors, drives this phenomenon called tolerance, lowers your serotonin, causes unhappiness, and is at the, you know, fundamental basis of this phenomenon called metabolic syndrome. And we even know how. We've got the biochemical mechanism for how this occurs. Now, sugar is not the only problem in processed food, but it is the biggest problem. It used to be trans fats, but they're out of our diet finally. Took 25 years, but we got them out. Now we have sugar as the biggest problem. Ultimately, real food solves the depression problem, solves the addiction problem, solves the metabolic syndrome problem. You know, we need to basically consume real food. And there are several real food advocates in the audience right now. Joan Ifland is a psychiatrist who has written an entire textbook on food addiction. Laurel Mellon is in the back as well, who is spent her entire career battling processed food and childhood anxiety disorders and difficulties. So we know what the problem is. What we don't yet know is how to convince society that this is a big priority to do something about it.
So I want to add another large effect, and that is loneliness. So social isolation, feelings of loneliness, even if you're in a room of people and with people all day, is increasing. And even in young people and 20-year-olds, their level of loneliness is at much, much higher levels than ever before.
Well, why? That's through technology.
So, Rob, okay. I'll let you go.
No, okay.
So I was going to say that screen time is part of that, but that's not all. Yeah.
I think that's a biggie, though. This is an analogy I think is really interesting. I think you're, Wolfram, you might particularly like this one. I'm going to read the whole question in the comments, and I'm going to have to plagiarize this one. Sorry, whoever wrote it. What are the specific actions that our government is not currently doing to counteract the dangerous practices of the food industry? Meaning, where are the airbags, shoulder bags, and anti-lock brake regulations? Isn't that a great analogy?
Great analogy.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Go ahead. So, I mean, the lack of transparency in our food system is really one of the number one issues. If you're concerned about sugars or you're concerned about processed foods, how are you going to know what's in your food if the labels on the front of the box or the bag or the labels on the back aren't telling you, they're just telling you a fraction of the story. So just things like getting added sugars put on the food label and many of the other ingredients that are added to food, the, you know, food-like substances. And Rob is, you know, often quotes, you know, if it has a label, it's a warning label. It's definitely good advice.
Real food doesn't have a label.
Yeah. but unfortunately, most of the food that people are eating today do have labels. And if it has a label, it should be more accurate. So I'm working on a company that's developing a platform that can provide filters and information so you can make real-time decisions about purchasing food based on knowledge, based on information that isn't being shared. And I think ultimately it's consumer solutions about finding information about food that will pass over government and the food industry, our desire for more information and getting that information, regardless of how much the government wants to give us or the companies want to give us, I think is what's going to drive the future of food.
Mm-hmm. Let me just bring in one more point of it, and that is cost, right? So the cheap food is the bad quality food, but that's the food people can afford quite often. So we have to be very mindful of that and probably propose certain regulations, right, on the food cost, because right now we see in the Bay Area the food cost of food goes up exponentially, and that also reflects on the quality.
Okay, I'm going to say something totally politically incorrect.
Okay, go for it.
But I'm going to do it anyway because I can't help myself. Because I probably had too many cups of coffee this morning. We just suffered through one of the most hellacious weekends in our history. And after my horror and my shock and my denial and my dealing with it, I thought to myself, wait a second, who was this guy? Who was Robert Bowers? Who was he? He's a truck driver, long-haul truck driver. What do long-haul truck drivers eat?
Processed food.
Is there any possibility that the violence that we're seeing in our society right now might be related to what we're eating? In fact, we have data in toddlers on sugar and irritability. There's data from correlative data now. It's all correlative data. We don't have causative data. Correlative data on sugar and violence in middle schools in Boston. So is it possible that the food we're eating is actually now manifesting itself in our current violence paradigm that we're seeing? And how are we going to fix that? So I don't know the answer to that. I don't have proof. And, you know, I'm all about the science, but I can tell you it correlates. I can't tell you it's causative. But I think we need to find out.
Yes. Okay, I'm going to ask some specific... I'm going to end the questions with, like, what to do when we get home kind of questions, the food aspect. So I'm going to ask you some of the more technical ones right now. And... this person wants to know about the metabolic health factor in the treatment and management of neurodegenerative disorders and different dementias. So I don't know who is more into that, but I have a bunch.
I can start, and then
thank you.
The group will
well, and then and but I have a lot more,
up.
So you can start.
Okay, so let me just go back to one more thing. It's not just the quality of food. It's also the quantity of food, and it's also the frequency of food intake. And we don't think about it, but insulin is a very pulsatile hormone. It's produced with very, very well defined rhythmicity all over the 24-hour period. And whenever what Elisa was saying, you know, when people don't sleep or when people are stressed out, there are a number of disruptors which disrupt that pulsatility. When you don't eat, and a lot of us, I'm not going to point fingers because we all know that, we don't eat regularly. We have something in the morning, then we starve ourselves during lunch or whatever, skip, and then we have 4 o'clock rush, and then we have a large dinner or snack half a night. That in itself is a major disruptor. Here's what happens in the brain, just to be very specific to the question. We don't need glucose monitoring, with all due respect, to know that in the brain, every single time when there is change in a glucose concentration in a vulnerable brain, there is a disruption of the activity of the pivotal areas and the connectivity between those areas. So we can take it as a given. We don't need to keep discovering that. What we do need to know is that if we want certain health and certain stability and remove the oscillation, we need to eat more frequently, less amount, and give ourselves that period at night when we actually are supposed to sleep. So whenever we're sleepless and watch or play video games, try to not eat. That's one of the easy ways to decrease the cognitive disruption and the changes in the brain, which might eventually lead to neurodegenerative disease.
Oh, wonderful. Alyssa, I'm going to hand this one to you. There's lots of food. I'm going to do that a little bit differently in a moment. I'm going to read them all because they're all so similar. But this one, this question, I think, back to those sleep, stress, what strategies can help us reset?
Mm-hmm. So with sleep, what we do, the only way to affect your sleep at night is to affect what you do in the day. And so there, we published a paper, a large survey of Americans and Haynes, and we found that the less people sleep, the more they're having sugared soda, and especially sugared soda with caffeine, no surprise there. And so there's these relationships we don't even see in ourselves. So, you know, clearly coffee is, thank God, coming out as such a good player for our cognitive health, but not for our sleep, right? So limit it to the morning. And exercising, of course, helps. And if you can do it early, you're more likely to do it, period. Because the more you wait, the more things come up. So having a sleep ritual is critical. So these days, we all need curfews, not just our children, for screen time. And so we got to do this together. You have to do it with people you live with. Or if you live alone, you have more control. Because this is, we are, you know, these social animals, and we're completely influenced by who we're around, both eating, sleeping, and stress levels. Stress levels are also contagious. So whatever it is for you for that wind down period, for sure it shouldn't include eating and, you know, some herbal tea if it's early enough. In the telomere effect, we have a whole page just of bullet points saying, choose three of these, create your ritual, what's going to work for you. And creating a gap in the time that you don't eat is turning out to be really critical. There's just beautiful mouse studies showing that the longer you wait to give your liver a break and not eat from dinner to breakfast, or even, you know, skipping breakfast, that is really healthy. And that is something that is actually pretty easy to implement. So there's some human studies, some suggesting it helps with epilepsy for sure and dementia. But for all of us, we could use that liver break.
Wolfram, I have a question for you. But before you did, just a brief clarification, you mentioned telomeres, and some people may not know what that is. Can you give a brief description? I like the description in your book about the end caps, like the tips of your laces in your shoes. Mm-hmm. Just a brief on telomeres.
So the telomeres, these protective caps at the ends of our genes, protect the genes. But they're also, in order to protect them, they're super sensitive to the environment, the cellular environment. So every, you know, many things that we do feel, think, are changing the cellular environment and impacting the telomeres. So many of our lifestyle factors are associated with the length of our telomeres. So you want them to be sturdy and last throughout your life so that our cells can keep replicating. And our cells, when the telomeres are short, the cell basically dies or stops replicating.
It's exposed, yeah.
And so we are everything we've talked about is related to telomeres, you know, in terms of like mental health issues are related to shorter telomeres. And one of the things that everything we're talking about is important to protect our telomeres. The big things on the list are smoking and soda and processed red meat. And the important things are getting enough sleep, managing stress, whole food diet. So there's no big surprises in how to protect them. But once you know about them, you know you have them in every cell, you know that they're listening to your thoughts and your behavior every day, it can be very motivating to protect them.
Great. Wolfram, this question is, with blocking of a food cravings in a strategy to prevent metabolic syndrome, can you tie that question into hypoglycemia?
Sure. So, I mean, we've talked about processed foods. It's amazing the effect once you back those out of your diet and focus on real food, how much that helps you in terms of being on that hamster wheel of craving foods that are high in, you know, sugar, salt, and unhealthy fat. I've also been, we have a couple of experts here in the audience. One is Dr. Joan Ifland, who does some really amazing work around processed food and processed food addiction. Also, Julia Ross, she's written a recent book, The Craving Cure. And I've been experimenting with amino acids, because we know I've been a high-carb vegetarian for many years, and we know that you know, parts of our diet are incomplete. There's some, you know, clearly some things that are missing from our diets, and there's, at least from my experience, pretty good effect of amino acids helping me with not only my cravings for carbohydrates, which I think we all experience, but also with sleep. Of course, pulling out the processed foods, the high sugar, salt, and fat, has a huge effect. And it's one of the first things that we talk to anybody who comes to the Hypoglycemia Support Foundation is obviously to focus on diet. That's the one thing you can control the easiest. We don't have much faith in the the pharma solutions, the gastric bypasses, and those may be temporary fixes or fixes for a small percentage of people, but for the vast majority that come to us, it's really talking about diet, real food, and just trying to eliminate those cravings in a healthy way.
I have two questions. I'm going to backtrack a little from what I just said, because two of these questions deal with the same thing, and that is, without reading them both, maybe I will read them both. They're both about fatty liver disease. Just a moment. They're both, I'm going to read the one, but they're both dealing with fatty liver. Is there evidence of reversing fatty liver and other syndromes? Don't get into other syndromes, because that's another question. Talk about, is there a way to prevent, and maybe go through each of you and answer that. You know what? I am going to backtrack. I apologize. I can't sit down anymore. Let me do this. So I'm going to read these all. Just bear with me here. So I'm going to read all of these, and you pick. You kind of think about the ones that you want to answer. Is that okay? Okay. Chemical companies are suppressing their pre-knowledge of toxic load. Are there lawsuits? Is there evidence? That's you, Rob. Are there evidence? Is there evidence of reversing fatty liver and other syndromes? So that's one. And this person has non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and agitated depression. And they're basically asking for help. What should I eat for breakfast, for lunch, for dinner? And this is what is the connection between allergies and metabolic syndrome? And this person has anxiety with CBD. Is this unhealthy, metabolically speaking? So tell us the steps to take as to what, I know, just bear with me. Tell us the steps what to do, what to eat, what to avoid. They need to go home with you guys and get rid of metabolic syndrome. Plus, how do we know for sure that we have it? Almost done. Could you comment on having multiple autoimmune diseases? Causes. There's another one. We touched on some of these. This person's concerned about GMO foods, which we've touched on when Dr. Appel was talking about glyphosate. Addiction to brain-altering processed food. Please address. Two more. But you see there's a theme here, right? How can type 2 diabetes be reversed through diet? And this is the interesting one. Can you do the same for mitochondrial dysfunction? And then to finish it up, what should we eat? A whole foods, plant-based diet? Don't people eat junk food in good times and bad? We have stress, less sleep. People just want, how do I break a sugar addiction? They're all basically, go ahead, Wolfram, you start and let's go down. I know, but you get the gist.
Great questions. Let's book another hour, but yeah.
Well, I think I'm on this panel because I'm the every man, the everyday guy. I'm not a scientist or a doctor. I've been working in the trenches and, communities the last four decades. When you talk about fatty liver disease, we hear some of the scientific definitions, but how do they, what is fatty liver? It's, foie gras. We're turning our livers into foie gras. And what do they feed ducks to get foie gras? Well, they literally feed them a high carb, processed carbohydrate diet. In some cases, they actually recycle old candy. So, like after Halloween and so on, there's a lot of candy on the shelves. And when they want to fatten up certain animals and you want to get a fatty liver, you just literally feed them candy, just sugar. So, just to get a mental picture of how you get fatty liver disease, that's a pretty, pretty good one. So obviously focusing on real food, learning how to cook, I think is really a critical question.
That's a great take home there.
And I've just found that yes, I spend more time now cooking than I used to earlier in life, but I spend a lot less time at the hospital. So where do you want to spend your time, cooking or at the hospital?
Or where do you want to spend your money?
Yeah. So I don't necessarily want real food to be cheaper. Because food is only cheap when you externalize the costs of all this healthcare and type 2 diabetes, which I think is something like $10,000 per person with diabetes. It's, you know, there's so much money that we're throwing away on the disease versus I honestly want the best food I can buy. And so I'm less concerned about the cost of the food than I am the quality of the food. Also, being in the food system space, there's just a nonstop debate between the plant eaters and the meat eaters. The macronutrient wars.
They're both death eaters.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I live on the plant-based side, but not for scientific reasons, for spiritual reasons. But what I see is that the common denominator is when you pull out processed foods from whether it's a plant-based or an animal-based, whether you're on keto, paleo, or you're vegan, when you pull out the processed foods, that's what makes the difference. You can eat plant-based. Sugar is plant-based. Most processed foods are plant-based. So
Coke is vegan, okay?
Being plant-based doesn't get you off the hook. What gets you off the hook is pulling out those ultra-processed foods with the bad sugars and the salts and the fat.
Okay, I
just want to say that Wolfram said it exactly right, and I have nothing else to say because he said it exactly right.
Oh, that can't possibly be.
It doesn't matter. Okay. Whole food plant-based is code for vegan. Okay, just know that. Whole food plant-based is code for vegan. Okay, vegans get sick too. Now, they don't get sick if they do veganism right. Well, guess what? Low-carbers don't get sick if they do low-carb right. In fact, everyone who eats any diet that is not processed food does it right. Pick your diet.
Yeah.
I don't give a crap.
So,
okay, Mediterranean, vegan, Atkins, keto, traditional Japanese, Mediterranean, sugar busters, zone, you know, down the line, every single one of them is real food.
Alyssa?
Real food works, processed food doesn't.
Okay,
period.
I was trying to be very politically correct all hour. I think I'm abandoning it. In Japan, and in China, by the way, there is a profound epidemic of diabetes right now.
11% diabetes.
So let's not try to forget that. Foie gras. The reason those ducks get fat, not only because they're fed carbohydrates, but because they're kept in inactivity. So please let's not forget that too. In France, people walk and they eat foie gras and they don't have the same rates of obesity and diabetes. So again, let's not forget about that. Fatty liver, just one more thing and I will shut up about that. Alcohol, we keep forgetting a little bit about one of the major modulators of mood and anxiety here, which is alcohol. If we drink less, and we drink less beer specifically, we will have less fatty liver.
True.
Alyssa, you have a comment.
True. The science is interesting. It will continue to get more and more specific about mechanisms. We know enough. We know what the big toxic things are. Let's just take sugar soda, for example. Why do we still drink it? Because we are not in full control of our behavior, period. And people, especially if people are of low income and they're surrounded by it in their environments. So this is very low-hanging fruit for all of us. Where do you spend your time every day? Schools, workplaces, we need to take control because it's not going to be through the government and create these healthy food environments. Example, UCSF banned all sugared beverages from all campuses. What did we find? We evaluated it. We found that wastes shrunk, particularly of the most high-risk employees, people of low income, people who are service workers who were drinking like a liter a day. It reduced dramatically. People want help. They just need a supportive food environment.
Oh.
Yes, thank you. Bottles.
Right on.
Well, what I have to do, because again, this is being recorded, I'm going to do our final, you know, thank you. And then we'll all walk right out there because I have a feeling there might be some more questions and you'll definitely want to get all of their books. So in essence, my goodness, thank you all so much, right, for your comments here today. And we also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 114th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.
Yay, everybody.